accession number 33130, rule 5.
Captain Kett, tape 3, side A. I see from your information that you actually got a DSC in bar.
Yes.
Can you tell me something about the actions that these were awarded for?
Well, I think the first DSC was for taking stores to Malta. I was first lieutenant and I did 5 voyages, and it was really up to me to discharge it. And so, to my surprise, I was the only one of the ship that got the reward. But I think the captain must have realised that, and he did write to me when he retired and said, thank you for carrying on your back for 18 months, which I virtually had done. Mm. He was a commander and I was only a lieutenant. But that was the first DSC, it was for service in submarines. And the second one was more or less for sinking the submarine, but again, it was for service in submarines. Mm. I sank nearly 17 ships, I think. Mm. That's where it came down to. I went to the palace to get the first one, but because of the king's health, I got the second one by post.
That must have been quite a thrill to meet the king.
Who?
When you went and got the first one.
Yeah, I had actually met him before.
Uh-huh.
When I did the gunnery course, he came down to tea with us. And we only stood one side of the table and he came down on the other side. And, you know, he had a terrible stutter.
Mm-hmm.
And when they said, would you like tea, sir, green or Indian or China, he just said, China. And then they got a rating to come who had served with him at Jutland, because he'd been young in Jutland. And the poor man came and walked all round and saluted and stood there. And the king couldn't say a single word. And eventually the Admiral said, very good, Blake, or whatever your name was, and he saluted and went away again. And then a year or so later, he came down to Portsmouth to review a motorboat flotilla, and he expressed a desire to meet some naval officers who've actually been in contact with the enemy.
Mm.
And the only people they could find in the whole of Portsmouth who had actually been in contact with the enemy were 6 submariners. We were the 6 doing the CO's course. So we was quickly told in our old clothes to rush round the dockyard, and we lined up in a row, and suddenly there were about 1,000 troops lined up behind us, and the king came and shook hands with each of us. And by that time he could begin to speak fairly well. So he would say, which ship? And you would say Clyde or Oberon or whatever it was. And he said to one, which ship? And he said, Tigris, something like that. And he said, oh, where is she now? She's refitting. The king was able to say that. And they said, well, no, sir, she's on patrol. And he said, well, they have lied to me, because the CO Mars, who came to my wedding, had just been awarded a VC, and they had said he can't wait for a proper investiture, and the king had a separate investiture for... so he was able to say, then they lied to me. I thought he was a wonderful man.
Mm.
I was lucky to meet him 3 times, I suppose.
Did he remember you when you went the 3rd time?
No. He asked me which ship, and I said Clyde. Yeah. I've been lucky to meet the royal family. I've met them quite a lot.
Yes, you said you were the aide-de-camp, weren't you?
That was with this queen, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It sort of gives you an insight into the royal family, does it? A little bit.
Well,
I wouldn't know. I would never ask you to any confidence, of course.
That have you got a sword? And I said yes. Mm. All right. This is very secret. Keep it to yourself. Mm. This is what they asked me. But stand by to do something. So I stood by. And then, if you remember, you probably don't. Chichester became ill. He had got pneumonia, so the whole thing was postponed for 2 or 3 months. And then suddenly it was all on again. And I was told, and I had aiguillettes and things from Deptford, And then I was told to join Buckingham Palace at 8 o'clock in the morning, or 10 o'clock, whatever it was. So, and I would be met. So I went to Buckingham Palace. They gave me a royal car from the Officers Royal Naval Club where I stayed the night. And I was driven into the palace, and I was met by a fellow, no, by a janitor chap, and who took me to Lord Plunkett's room, which was quite a lovely room. And oddly enough, on the table was the Daily Mirror. That was the only paper. And I sat there. Lord Plunkett was supposed to brief me and tell me what was to happen. But I just sat there and I read the Daily Mirror and looked at the lovely paintings. And suddenly he breezed in and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've been up all night. There's some bumps here for you to read, but you haven't got time to read it now. Come on." That was my briefing. And then we walked along the corridor and we met Philip and Sir Michael Adeen, who was in Queen's Equerry or something. And we just stood there, and then a little boy ran through our midst, and it was either Prince Andrew or one of the young princes, and the girl, who was Lady Mary Morrison, was the Queen's lady-in-waiting, and she said, "Andrew, you shouldn't do that," or something like that. And then the Queen came along and they just introduced me, and we all went in the cars to Greenwich. Again, I didn't have time to read even in the car. A, people were waving, and secondly, Mary was talking to me. She was a lovely lady. She was really a charming person who was putting me at ease, and I didn't feel the slightest worry at all. And she said, "Would you like a Benzedrine tablet?" And I said, "What on earth would I want that for?" "Well, I've just taken one. Don't you feel nervous?" And I said, "No, not the slightest." I didn't. And when we got there, I was told, you know, as an ADC, you are representing the Queen. So if an admiral or anyone salutes you, you don't answer back. You had to remember not to return the salute, which was a bit tricky when you got there. And then, I don't know why I'm telling you all this. Oh, well, and then when we got to Greenwich, of course, we went and we met Sir Chichester and his wife, who was in red trousers, which shocked most people. And then she was knighted. And I mean, all I said, Sir Michael Adeen was quite a nice man too. And I said, he said, "You stand wherever the Queen is, you're behind her. So if she gives any orders, she doesn't give them direct. She gives them through her ADC. That's the history of the thing." So that's all I did, you see. And when it was all over, we drove back into the palace in the same car. And we went into the hall, which was their private hall. There was a rocking horse, and as soon as we got out, there was a butler chap with two corgis, and he led the Queen away to take the dogs for a walk. And then the Duke said to me, "Have you had to come far?" And I said, "No, sir, not at, I live in Harwich. I'm a Trinity House pilot." And he said, and this is the actual words he said, "Oh, I was opened the Thames navigation yesterday, and they said the trouble with London, there are too many bloody pilots." And I said, "Well, that's not fair, sir." And I was about to explain to him how unfair it was, but he said, "Oh, here she comes." And we all stood at attention, and the Queen came back, and she came to me and said, "Thank you for coming." And I said, "It's been a great honour, ma'am." And that was the end of that. But then a very nice thing happened. They all went away, and I walked down to the corridor, and they had got the car to take me back to my club, and Lord Plunkett took me, and he was quite a dry, short young man. And then suddenly there was a clip, clip, clip. A young lady came running along the corridor, and it was this lady, Mary Morrison. And she said, "Oh, Captain Kett, I'm so sorry I wasn't able to say goodbye to you, but I had to help the Queen get in the lift or something." And I really thought she was absolutely lovely, that quite a young woman she was. I don't know who she was. She was called the Honourable Mary Morrison. What she became, I never, ever found out. But she was very nice. Where Plunkett was a bit of a drip. Sir Michael Adeen was nice enough, but we didn't have time to do any conversing. Anyway.
And you had an RD and clasp.
Pardon?
An RD and clasp
well,
decoration. What is that?
Like undetected crime decoration. You get a Royal Naval RD decoration, that's right, for being 15 years in the service,
mm-hmm.
and then a clasp for the second 15 years. In actual fact, I was in the reserve for actually 30 years, but I didn't get the second clasp, which I ought to have got, but because I had been injured and I'd spent 14 months not on reserve when I was invalid. When the war ended, the then Labour government, in order to safeguard themselves that you couldn't sue them later on, you had to go to a doctor and be medically examined. And I'd gone to the doctor, been medically examined as A1, and I think it was called. And as I walked out of the door, he'd signed the certificate. He said, "Oh, by the way, have you ever had a hurt certificate?" And I said, "Well, I did, actually. I fell and broke my shoulder from a submarine. I was pushed over the side by the gun." Oh, and he tore up my... And the next minute, I was in hospital. And I was still in command of a submarine. And I said to the surgeon, captain or admiral, I don't know what they were, "What the hell am I here for? I was going up and down the conning tower all yesterday." And it went on and on. And I said, "I want to get back again. I can't waste my time here." And eventually I was medically examined by a lot of six doctors, and they came to the conclusion that I had a slight injury which might in future cause me trouble. I can't get it up anyway. And so I was invalided out, and I got a pension of £1 a week. Well, going to Trinity House, it was an absolute embarrassment to me, climbing up ladders. The Trinity House would never have employed me if they thought I was unfit for the Navy. So I started playing hockey and all sorts of things, rowing, and eventually wrote to the Admiralty and said, "This pension is an embarrassment to me. I would like another medical exam," and I had it, and of course they pronounced me A1. So I was reappointed in the reserve with original seniority. But when it came to getting the second clasp, Admiral Place was the Admiral by that time, Admiral Commanding Reserve, said, "Because you missed 1 year, we don't think you should have it." It was really quite petty, but didn't worry me at all.
Do you like to... is there anything that you think you haven't told me that I ought to know? They haven't covered?
I think I've told you far more than enough. No, I really can't think of
it. Can you think of any funny things that happened along the way, that funny incidents?
Well, I told you the funniest thing was when I called the Admiral a bloody fool,
oh, yes.
But I told you that. But that was really marvellous. And, you know, I met him afterwards at a cocktail party, and he said, "You know, you saved my life that night." Well, of course, a lot of funny things happened, but I really can't remember them. It's a long while ago, you know.
Did you find, because you were in the submarine service, that the rest of the naval officers treated you as slightly differently? Were you like an elite amongst yourselves, or did you did you have a sort of camaraderie amongst yourself? But
you're absolutely right. You see, unlike the Air Force, at least I don't know much about the Army, they all promoted themselves very quickly.
Mm.
I was a navigator as a lieutenant, I was first lieutenant as a lieutenant, I was a CO as a lieutenant, and I was a senior officer of the flotilla as still a lieutenant.
Mm.
Only at the end of the war, we were granted the rank of quasi-lieutenant commander. Mm. It was just a courtesy title. But, so, yes, in the submarine service, COs were sort of, as you say, like God's elite. Mm. When you had to go, say, to a destroyer or that you were going to work with next day, you were just nobody.
Mm.
And I told you I went to Milford Haven. I haven't told you that story. When Ultimatum returned from Gib, from the Mediterranean after the war had finished, well, not quite, but we were no longer required, I was sent, because Ultimatum had been damaged and needed repair, I was sent round to Fishguard. Have I told you that?
No.
To do work with the American Air Force, who were dropping acoustic torpedoes, and we were to be the target. And the Admiral told me when I sailed, "This is very highly secret, and you're not to put any mention of it in any of report or your patrol report." And when I got there, I was sent to go to Milford Haven to the conference about how we were going to do this, you see. And when I got there, there was Admiral Milford Haven introduced them, and then there was another Admiral, and there were field marshals and all the rest of it, you see. And I, a poor little humble lieutenant, they all sat round a big table, and I sat behind in a chair eventually. And during the course of it, he explained what we were to do. The submarine was to dive, and the aircraft would fly over and drop a torpedo, and it was home on us. And if it hit us, it wouldn't have an explosion ahead. It would go, and we would be able to register that we'd been hit, and then we would surface and we would signal that one hit or whatever. And then, so that's how it was arranged. There was going to be one airplane dropping the bomb, one airplane watching, and a destroyer escorting the submarine and rendezvousing and keeping. And then suddenly the Admiral said, the biggest problem, of course, is this. We would like to recover the torpedo after it's been fired. And we, at the moment, we cannot see how we're going to do that. And a second thing, we might have to waste a hell of a lot of time trying to look for a submerged submarine, and there's no way we can identify where it is. And I couldn't stand this any longer, so I said, excuse me, sir, there's no problem. We will tow some buffs on the surface, so you'll always know where we are. And I said, we could also have a fluorescein plaque on the bridge, which would leave a track, so that the aircraft that photographing will see the route we've seen. And I said the torpedo could have a fluorescein pack, and when they fire it, you would be able to see whether it hit or missed. And the Admiral said, and who the hell are you? And I said, well, I'm the CEO of the submarine. Good gracious, man, what are you doing there? Make room. And I was then sat at the top of the table next to the Admiral, and that answers your question. In the submarine service, yes. And seniority, gold braids didn't make any difference. You were what you were. But when you went with other people, Air Force, Navy, you did become nothing. That was quite good. And then we got together, just the CEO of the aircraft and the destroyer. We worked together very well, and the whole exercise went beautifully. And Captain Admiral Submarines, when he sent me, said, look, if they damage you, keep an eye on a little island or something where you can beach. And he said, you are expendable. Well, in the event, they fired the torpedo, and it came bonk, bonk. It hit us about five times. Didn't do us any damage, just bang, 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 bang. So it turned out to be quite successful, I think. And that was the trial with the American Air Force on acoustic torpedoes.
Did you work with the Americans very often?
That was really the only time my submarine actually personally. Mm. We did occasionally become a target for, yes, but not me personally. We would have a flotilla. That was a big role that the submarine played, being a target for the destroyers, corvettes, Air Force.
And you said before that you didn't hunt in packs because there weren't very many of you.
Oh, we never went to sea together on patrol, ever. Well, there were only 57 submarines. No, and mind you, again, the Germans had convoys, great big 50 or 60 ships all streaming along. So the pack idea was a jolly good one for them. They used to pick up the convoy and then follow it until they had assembled enough U-boats to attack it. The Germans had very few ships at sea, did they? Mm. They had no merchant ships. They were a landlocked place. Mm. So we didn't have a lot of targets. The targets, when I was there, were ammunition lighters coming down from Marseille, the Rhine, and going along to Italy when our forces were driving the Germans up Italy. So most of the targets I managed to sink were ammunition carriers. That was our main object.
And when you'd hit them, they'd explode, I suppose, being ammunition.
Pardon?
When you'd hit them, they would explode, I suppose, being ammunition.
Yes, the first one I hit, I was a bit too close, and it exploded, and I cut my eye on the periscope. And it did a bit of damage to us, too. Our side lights were broken. That didn't really matter. But when at the beginning, when I was in Clyde, the Italians were our biggest enemy. We did sink a couple of Italian ships, and we did that by gunfire.
From the deck?
Well, that would be about 1941, I suppose. Yes. I got command in 42, so it would be 41.
So when you say by gunfire, you would have come up onto the surface and fired your gun at them?
Well, this was a naval ship, and she had been patrolling and more or less hunting us.
Mm.
And in the end, David Ingram, my commander, said, we'll surface and fire the gun at it. And, you know, when you're a submarine, you have an advantage to the extent that you were able to take the range exactly, 1,500 yards, and the bearing exactly. And so you told the gun there and the trainer what to do, and the officer put on the reins, and then you surfaced, and someone would go up with the breech and put it in the gun, someone else would bring a shell and put it in the gun. The trainer had already trained onto the target, the range had been put on pretty accurately, and you got your shot off before they were aware that you were on the surface.
Mm.
So it was essential that the submarine got the first shot in before they could reply. And the first shot we invariably hit, because we were doing it at a very short range. And that generally, they never really recovered from that. They did fire back, but we fired about 18 rounds, I think, and eventually put them all in the hull, and she turned over and sank. And that's when we picked them up and took them as prisoners. And when I went along to the fore ends and said, you know, I'm sorry about this, they said, oh, it's all right, c'est la guerre, it's all... I think, in actual fact, I always thought they were very relieved to be out of the war.
Yes.
They were going to be looked after better as our prisoners than they were as an Italian. Mm. But anyway, that was that.
So now, at 97...
Pardon?
So now at 97, as you look back over your naval life, do you have any regrets? Any high spots or low spots?
Not a single one, no.
No?
No. It was a wonderful period of my life. It's hard to say this, and most people who survived say it was the most rewarding 5 years of your life. You felt you were doing something really worthwhile, and after a while you begin to wonder if the rest of it was really worthwhile. Although piloting ships up and down the Thames and around the North Sea, I think, was fairly worthwhile at the time, but wartime is different, isn't it?
Yes, a lot.
Especially when you think your country is going to be probably invaded, and your mother and father and children and or sisters and girlfriends are all going to be killed. So you're doing your bit because you think it's worthwhile doing.
That's lovely. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Well,